Hi, this is Sylvester here on KUCI. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Tsang with Subversity. Today, Martin Luther King Day, a historic day, and also a historic day tomorrow. But we're going to look at the foreign policy of this new Obama administration and some troubling signs. And with us on the phone is Gary Loop, who's the a professor at Tufts University of History. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. You know, you've written a number of pieces about Obama's and his views on and his policy on Afghanistan and also on the Middle East. What is troubling to you about Obama?
Well, what's troubling to me is that he doesn't seem to be much of a change over George Bush. And I think that's been apparent to me for many months, but I think many supporters of Obama have had the supposition that somehow he is going to really represent change and hope and be an alternative to George Bush, and that probably the reason that he's president now is the fact that he was able to take advantage of the hope and expectation that he was going to withdraw troops from Iraq, and that he represented the, or that he constituted the anti-war candidate.
But you pointed out, that the fact that he's going to move troops to Afghanistan is no solution.
Yes, he's been declaring since mid-2007 that he thought that the real center of the war on terror ought to be, and has in fact been, Afghanistan, but that Bush took his eye off the ball and foolishly went into Iraq, which he has characterized as a huge strategic blunder. That's essentially as he's understood the Iraq war all along. He hasn't, that is to say, described that as an immoral war, certainly hasn't called it a war of aggression or an imperialist war, but rather a kind of tragic mistake. And what Bush really ought to have done is to have emphasized the need to go after al-Qaeda and to consolidate victory in Afghanistan.
And, of course, that's a continuation of U.S. imperialist policies.
Well, you say, of course, and I say, of course, that's certainly my understanding of the situation, but what he's on record as saying is we need to send in more troops. His generals are saying 30,000, and I think he's on board that program, actually. U.S. has to send in more troops in order to better control the situation in that country. And the paradoxical thing here is that Hamid Karzai, who basically is the U.S. man in Afghanistan, he was handpicked virtually by Zalmay Khalilzad over the favored king
the parliament there.
Yeah, well, the big gathering that took place in 2002.
Oh, God, yeah.
The U.S. essentially handpicked an English-speaking restaurateur from the Boston area to be the Pashtun, the Pashtun who had earlier been selected as a longtime CIA asset, had been killed, but Karzai was the next best candidate for the position. But the real people calling the shots in Afghanistan are the Northern Alliance folks, the Tajiks and Uzbeks, who have long been on the U.S. payroll and also friendly with Iran and India. But the status quo in Afghanistan is basically a collection of warlords who are now making a lot of money from opium traffic and human trafficking, a very traditional kind of arrangement of warlordism with the Pashtun, and Pashtuns are about 60% of the Afghan population, who is essentially the mayor of Kabul. And then you have the resurgent Talibs in the southern part of the country. And Karzai is trying to reach out to them, realizing that they're very traditionalist and reactionary Sunni Muslim program has a certain appeal in the hinterland. And he's saying we have to negotiate with the Taliban. Few people realize it, but for a time, Karzai was the foreign minister of the first Taliban regime. But he's saying to the U.S. and the foreigners, I would like you to set a deadline to withdraw, and I would like to negotiate with Mullah Omar. I'd like to give him safe passage to come and negotiate with me. And meanwhile, the U.S. is saying we need to have more troops in the country. They're not talking about setting a deadline at all. They have a bounty on the head of Mullah Omar. In other words, there are contradictions that are emerging between Karzai as U.S. puppet and the U.S. generals themselves. And very little media attention is going to this paradox that, in fact, even Karzai is saying, please withdraw. And by the way, please stop bombing civilians.
I mean, bombing of civilians are, of course, inevitable when you send in so many fighter bombs. And that's also the case with Israel in the Gaza. Why do you think Obama has not said anything, has kept his silence on the Gaza situation?
Well, I don't know. It would be quite remarkable should he, a couple days from now, give an address in which he says, Israel must understand that the U.S. is no longer going to give them carte blanche to engage in these kinds of overreactions. The French President Sarkozy has used the term disproportionality, and that's become quite respectable for Western leaders to criticize gently Israel for its disproportionate response. So it wouldn't be that great a political leap for Obama to say this was disproportionate. After all, these Khazar rockets have killed 15 or 17 Israeli citizens over the last 2 years, whereas the Israeli assault on what the Vatican diplomat has referred to as a concentration camp, and that's what Gaza is, really. You kill 1,100, of whom one-third are children. I mean, he could use this kind of language and not be all that controversial.
But that's not likely, is it?
Well, I'm just saying there's that option there. Having gone to such pains to try to be the uniter and build the bridges to all these factions, it is barely conceivable that he might surprise people by saying, I really want to show that I am a moderate and a centrist, and we've bent the stick too much in the direction of Israel. And so it is just possible that he might pull a surprise and say, I really do want to show some U.S. compassion towards the Palestinians and to urge a different course on the side of Israel.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
right.
I'm just saying that as a possibility. On the other hand, when you look at his picks for his cabinet and for key posts, the selection of Dennis Ross as apparently the number one guy under Hillary Clinton for the State Department on the Middle East and apparently as a kind of special envoy to Iran, the selection of Dennis Ross is really troubling. I think that's why you emailed me and suggested that we do this interview, is because you read my piece on Dissident Voice about Dennis Ross.
And you called him Obama's neocon. Why did you say that?
Well, because of his association with the really bad guys, Richard Perle and Wolfowitz, and those who are fully exposed for their thoroughly pro-Israel, pro-settlements ideology. Well, Dennis Ross, if you do the research, is very much in that same crowd.
He was a co-founder of AIPAC, which is Israel's propaganda arm in the U.S.
I think that I was wrong on that, and a number of people are wrong on that because some websites have replicated an error that goes back to one misrepresentation on one standard reference site. No, apparently he's not a co-founder, but he is a member, and
he's a member.
Yes, he is a member,
and corrected. Yeah.
Yes, he's a co-founder of WinApp, which is a kind of sister organization, and described by Rashid Ahmed of Colombia as the number one propaganda body in favor of Israel. It's a more academic type of organization, but involved in the Camp David negotiations, which, as you recall, enunciated the principle of Israel evacuating the West Bank and that becoming the basis of a Palestinian state on the basis of peace. He later facilitated the Israeli government's establishment of more settlements and finessing that with the U.S. politically, essentially saying to the Israeli government, well, there won't be that much of a backlash in the United States if you go ahead and continue to establish settlements. And now you've got about 300,000 Israeli settlers on the West Bank, with the idea being we're creating facts on the ground that are going to be impossible to undo. And the Bush administration essentially conceded that and said, well, we really can't go back 20 years or so. And so the Bush policy has been to renegotiate and to say, well, we'll trade other land, and we will have a contiguous state. That is, there will be land that will link Gaza to the West Bank. So there'll be a contiguous Palestinian state. And in return, Israel will absorb some of Palestinian land. But time passes, those Israeli settlements grow, and more of them continue to be established. And there's a strong faction within Israel that says, this is part of Eretz Israel. This is the land that God gave to us. There is the Christian Zionist lobby in this country, which is much more significant than the religious Jewish Zionist lobby. And I think the bet is that there's not going to be a significant Palestinian state. And that's what Obama is going to have to cope with.
Do you know, what's your analysis of how the war started this time? Or why it started? Israel blames the Hamas, and Hamas blames Israel.
The Israeli charge is that we just couldn't put up with this constant barrage of Qassar rockets and so on. First of all, if you look at these rockets, if you see some of the photographic images of these rockets, a lot of them are really small. I mean, they're the length of your arm. And a lot of these are not imported from Iran. A lot of these look to be homemade. These are desperately launched from from Gaza soil, some by Hamas, some from Islamic Jihad or other organizations. They're acts of desperation and frustration in response to the cutting off of food and medical supplies by Israel, this done very deliberately as punishment for the election of Hamas in January of 2006. There was the unilateral ceasefire or truce that was proclaimed by Hamas after being elected. There was the Egyptian brokered ceasefire last year. The Israelis have violated these. Hamas has generally shown restraint. The Israelis, and this has been acknowledged by CNN and other mainstream press, broke the current truce in the first week of November. But anyway, my point is that Gaza Palestinians have indeed been shooting off these rockets, generally ineffective, although they do certainly generate fear, which is the point. The point is, you cannot subject us to this collective pain, which does result in people dying for lack of medicine and so on, without any kind of response from us at all. And our response as Weapons of the Week is these primitive rockets that we're firing that have resulted in the death of 15 to 17 civilians on your side over the last couple of years. As for the timing of the Israeli response, why did it have to occur in the last week of December? I think it has a lot to do with domestic Israeli politics, which is to say the coalition in power vis-a-vis the Likud party, in order to kind of bolster their macho credentials vis-a-vis Netanyahu. And also I think it was a test of the Obama forces to see how they would react. The Bush administration, of course, reacted by saying, yes, we understand Israel's doing what they have to do. And that exchange between Condoleezza Rice and Olmert was kind of interesting. You recall that she helped to compose a UNSC resolution and was prepared to vote for it. And then Olmert claims that he called up Bush, who then called up Connie and said, don't vote for it. Hmm. And she, in fact, didn't vote for it at the last minute to the puzzlement of other UN ambassadors. And then he claimed that he shamed her by forcing the president of the U.S. to tell her not to vote for it. And then the State Department kind of denied that that had happened. But I think that this is an effort of Israel to show what power it can exercise vis-a-vis the U.S. government. So in terms of the Bush administration, the fact that Obama hasn't said anything might be a source of some concern to the Israelis. On the one hand, they're probably happy that he didn't come out and say anything denunciatory, but they might be nervous that he didn't say anything in overt support either. Hmm. Nor did Ackerman, when he appeared on Meet the Press or something, and I don't think Rahm Emanuel did either. I think they're pleased that he has some prominent Zionists in his immediate circle, but they might be worried.
Yeah, wonderful.
So I don't know. I think that they probably would have liked to get a sense of where Obama stands in these days before his inauguration, but I don't think that they've gotten much of a sense yet.
One of the historians here at UC Irvine, Mark Levine, has written this piece that was published in Al Jazeera and also on the History News Network, where he suggests that the arguments that Israel gives for this is a defensive war is not valid, because he says that even the Israeli intelligence think tank, the Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center, in last December, just reported that was sporadically violated, this truce, and then not by Hamas, but by other so-called rogue terrorist organizations.
Yeah, Hamas actually jailed people for firing rockets.
Huh.
When they found them, but it's possible to send off rockets without being detected.
And they said this report said that the escalation and erosion of the Lau arrangement occurred after Israel killed half a dozen Hamas members on November 4th without provocation, and then placed the entire strip under Gaza Strip under more intensive siege the next day, which is Levine's comment. And so do you know if Israeli popular support for this has been eroding? I read an account where a doctor, Israeli doctor who was working in the Gaza, had his two daughters killed, and he was a volunteer who wanted, a doctor went to the Gaza to work for peace, and he was about to be on TV, and he called.
I think it's an Arab Israeli.
Arab Israeli,
by the name.
Right. Arab Israeli,
yeah.
Right. And he had been going back and forth with some trouble, but getting in, and then that was how they rewarded him for doing humanitarian work.
Yeah, I've read about that, but not very closely. I would hope that this would help to erode support, but the statistics I've seen are pretty overwhelmingly in support.
The polling data, yeah.
Yeah, in Israel.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you think it would resolve itself if, you suggested Obama might come up with a statement, but how would it, what would it do?
Well, I'm saying that is a possibility. I just don't want to suggest that there's any inevitability here. I am doing a lot of thinking about why this total support for Israel exists. As a Marxist, I find it very difficult to understand this in traditional economic terms. For example, it's not big oil, certainly, or the military-industrial complex in general that is backing this total support for Israel policy. The Israel lobby is not a lobby that makes an argument that this is really good for the health of the U.S. economy. It's not like the occasional intelligence and military services that Israel provides to the United States justifies $2.5 or $3 billion in U.S. aid every year. And it's not like the costs to American capitalism are really justified by the returns that are received through the investment in Israel.
But don't you think the weapons manufacturing here would support, it's because Israel is the, getting all its weapons from us, wouldn't it support the military industrial complex?
I don't think that alone would really explain it. I think that there are ideological issues. I think in particular politicians concern for the support of religious voters who believe that the reconstitution of a Jewish state in Israel in 1948 is the fulfillment of prophecy, concern with their support. This has to be understood in large part, I think, ideologically. But that could change if there are decisions made that it's more important for us to maintain friendly relations with the Arab world, with the Muslim world, than to maintain this close association with a nation that is perceived as vicious in its policy towards the Palestinians. This last instance is really a question, as I wrote in one column, of shooting fish in a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
With virtually no appreciable resistance, inaugurating this blitzkrieg on a captive population. They cannot flee.
Yeah, yeah.
They're trapped. And here you are attacking anybody in a Hamas uniform. They can be traffic cops, anybody at all, attacking military or police training centers, and basically inflicting fear and trying to instill a sense of defeat. That is really the psychological intention, to make these people realize that they are defeated and that they have to obey. And this is followed up by Condoleezza Rice's comment that really these people need to vote for Fatah and for Mahmoud Abbas. And then, Gaza can be reconstructed by Saudi money, and so long as they obey, then Israel will lighten up somehow. But I think that this international perception that the Israelis are using sheer brutality in order to force these people to obey and submit it can really backfire, it can really make the United States look bad, and at a certain point in the not-too-distant future, there could be a reappraisal such that corporate America might decide to rethink its relationship to Israel.
Even though he's picked these people that are pretty much not for change. Obama, I mean.
Yeah, well, I'm saying that's not necessarily
inevitable. Yeah,
inevitable that right now the ideological proclivity of those in power is to follow the lobby, but the logic of U.S. imperialism itself might cause a change in policy. I'm saying that as someone who's opposed to U.S. imperialism itself.
You've studied history of wars, and or at least history, and I mean, when you bomb people, they don't usually submit, do they?
I guess it depends on how bad. There are people who've been exterminated historically, but
that's true. Yeah, I mean, people that put up resistance and they hate you more.
Yeah, that's been the case with the Palestinians so far.
Yeah. We're listening to an interview with Gary Loop, a professor at Tufts University. This is Dan Sang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and on the web at kuci.org. So how do you think it's going to... do you believe that they're going to set up some kind of a commission to deal with this in the aftermath of this truce?
I don't know. There's been talk about some sort of international force being stationed within Gaza. Hamas has rejected that. There's been talk about an international force beyond that which already exists, policing the Egyptian border with Gaza in order to prevent weapons smuggling. I have no idea what's going to take shape in the next week or so of negotiations.
What Israel wants is to get rid of Hamas, right?
Yes. And I think there has been some negotiations, no doubt, behind the scenes between Israel and Egypt and the Palestinian Authority under Fatah. and yes, and the United States.
And some of the Arab countries don't want Hamas either.
I think generally speaking, the Arab governments do not like Hamas. They see it as a threat to themselves.
But it
needs to be emphasized that Hamas was democratically elected in January 2006. And
right.
that was a result of the disillusionment of the Palestinian masses, both on the West Bank and Gaza, but particularly in Gaza, where they got a greater share of the vote. The disillusionment with Fatah, because having signed the Camp David agreements, which established the Palestinian Authority and gave them limited administrative authority over the Palestinians in the occupied territories, which means right to collect taxes and control over things like postal services and telephone services and a kind of proto-state apparatus under Israeli control. They received office space and salaries and reputations for corruption.
And
inefficacy and very little progress towards an actual Palestinian state. And on the other hand, Hamas developed a reputation, and Hamas goes back to the 1980s when it actually arose out of Israeli-funded mosques in Gaza because the Israelis felt that supporting Muslim fundamentalism would weaken the secular-based political movement. And there's good documentation of this, and it was something acknowledged by Yasser Arafat as well. I'm going to publish something, actually, that brings a lot of this stuff together.
Okay.
But Hamas received support because its members were seen as religiously upright and principled, and they provided a lot of social services to people, rather like Hezbollah in Lebanon, although Hezbollah is a very different type of group. It's Shiite Muslim, not Sunni Muslim. And it's much more closely affiliated with Iran. There's a lot of talk about Hamas being in Iran's pocket, but it's more closely associated with Syria, actually. But anyway, so Hamas is democratically elected into power, and that's something that the U.S. and Israel just can't forgive, and so they subject it to essentially a boycott. It's saying to the people of Gaza, if you're going to elect these terrorists, then we're going to cut off your food supply and your medical supply, or we're going to minimize it so that you pay. And then in June 2007, in a plan apparently authored by Elliot Abrams in the State Department, one of the surviving neocons at that point, Fatah attempted to seize control in Gaza, but failed, and Hamas was able to essentially pull off a counter-coup. But that's been represented as a power grab by Hamas, which reverses the actual situation. It wasn't Hamas that seized power, which is to say, elbowed aside its partners in the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah. It's rather Fatah that tried to use their power on its own behalf, but Hamas got word of what was going on, and so it preemptively took power.
Right.
I'm not sure where I was going with this, but...
Yeah, but what role do you see former President Jimmy Carter playing? He called the Israeli treatment of Palestinians apartheid in his book.
Yes.
And so do you see him as playing a role in the new Obama administration?
Well, look what happened to Jimmy Carter as a result of writing that book. And I'm no big fan of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, I think, would like to be remembered as a president who emphasized human rights,
right,
coming to power after the Reagan administration, the Ford administration, that were so tainted by, well, so much evil. But he, of course, was president when the Shah of Iran was toppled, and he allowed him to be received to the United States and didn't extradite him to stand trial in Iran. And he was also the president when Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about using the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan to bleed the Soviets, and to bleed them as the Soviets had bled the United States during the Vietnam War. And he was president when the U.S. began to recruit Muslim jihadis from around the world in Afghanistan, thereby ultimately producing Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and so on. But anyway, this Jimmy Carter happens to be a bright guy with a fairly dispassionate attitude towards the Middle East, so he writes this book mentioning Israeli apartheid, and as a result, he's excluded from even appearing at the Democratic Convention. Because Alan Dershowitz basically, he uses his clout and the lobby's clout to force him off the stage. But anyway, that just tells you the limits of honesty that are allowed in the contemporary political environment. So I don't know. I think Obama would confront a lot of opposition if he tried to make use of Jimmy Carter.
I think they did have lunch or breakfast, right? I mean, with the former presidents. The former presidents did meet.
Yeah, all together in the White House.
Yeah, yeah.
That was not his initiative. That would have been Bush's initiative.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Carter came to give a talk at UCI after the book was published, and we taped the talk, the KUCI did, so I've been actually playing it sometimes. Because it does, one thing he did say was he encouraged students to go visit there, and a couple groups actually did go, Israeli student group and a Muslim student association on campus did send a delegation over, came back with kind of observations on person-to-person, the kind of student observations on what was going on. I'm not sure if it changed anybody's mind, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Dialogue is good, yeah. I noticed you also wrote about Bill Ayers, and you had signed a petition supporting him when he was the focus of right-wing attacks during the campaign. And actually, people forget that it was Hillary Clinton that brought it up, Billy Ayers, Obama's ties to Bill Ayers during the earlier part of the campaign. Why do you think that kind of smear job didn't stick in the end?
I didn't realize that Clinton is the one who had brought it up before Palin.
Yeah, he had brought it up in one of the primaries, yeah, at one of the debates or whatever it was, McCain continued it later.
That's a good question. I suppose that the people who supported Obama would not be much influenced by that sort of argument, because people looking back at that period would have a kind of sympathy with anybody opposing the Vietnam War. I think that that raising the anti-war protests, even extreme and violent ones of the 1960s, would just kind of augment Obama's anti-war credentials, which again I don't think are very strong to begin with, but to kind of associate him with that era of opposing an unpopular war could backfire to those trying to do it.
But why didn't it, didn't mobilize enough people on the right, I guess, huh?
Right. It would simply speak to the to speak to those already hostile to Obama, I don't see it bringing more people into the hostile camp.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. The fact was that the right kept digging into it. They've dug up Prairie Fire, Weather Underground manifesto, and
yeah.
looked at some words in the introduction that Bill Ayers wrote, supposedly, and it was supposedly credited. He acknowledged, or he gave tribute to Sirhan Sirhan. And,
Yeah.
So there's all this kind of side things that came out during the campaign, but nothing really stuck.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But
you, in your piece, you did say that it was good that the 60s got brought up.
Yeah, and as I recall that piece, it seems so long ago now, but that raising the specter of the 60s, that was the title of it,
right,
as I recall.
Right.
That was something that was likely to backfire, because a lot of us, and I'm 53 now, look back at that period of the 60s as one of positive energy, of fighting back against oppression and racism and sexism, and a lot of Obama's support, a lot of his youthful support, comes from people who see that period in a very favorable light. And then there are people who see that as the cause of all our problems, people getting uppity. And, let those people maintain their stance. But I didn't think that would be very politically useful. And I was right.
Some liberals don't like that period, though. Like the editor of The Nation, Van Heuvel, right? She wrote a piece attacking Bill Ayers, saying he was just an arrogant, violent guy. And the LA Times did the same thing in their book review of his reprint of Fugitive Days, his autobiography about those days, saying he was this arrogant. The headline was some arrogant.
Yeah, well, it's one thing not to like him, and it's another thing to try to adduce the specter of the 60s in toto. And I think that was what was going on there. If somehow you associate Obama with the 60s as a decade, that kind of prettifies him. That associates him, I think, with positive memories on behalf of today's youth. College kids today, they look at the 60s as this really cool time.
You think they romanticize it somewhat?
I think they do, and that's not bad. That is, they don't see it as a threatening time. I think a lot of people in their 70s, maybe they see it. Well, that's when society really started to decay. That's when our values really started going downhill. There's a lot of very reactionary people who see the 60s in a negative light. But our youth today, I think, see that as the decade when things started to get a lot better.
For sure, yeah. Do you believe that? They don't know about the ideological kind of debates that the left had in those days. They wouldn't care.
Well, some do, some don't. But we need to educate them.
Yeah,
we need to educate them.
Yeah, this is. Do you find that as a professor, do you find that how do you reach them if people are just, looking up stuff on the web now? And is that why you write for Dissident Voice, which is a web publication, that you can reach more people that way?
Well, I started writing for Counterpunch, for Dissident Voice.
Yeah.
And that, I'm not sure how I branched out into Dissident Voice. Maybe I submitted something to Counterpunch, which was a little bit too radical, and since they wouldn't post it, I shifted to Dissident Voice.
You think Counterpunch has become more liberal?
It depends. Counterpunch has been willing to post pretty much everything that I send to them. There might have been one piece comparing Mao Zedong and Jefferson that didn't fly that one time. But anyway, I can't complain.
Do they pay at all?
No. Oh, no. Okay. That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of it. It's all just self-expression, and if they want to post it, they do. If not, no hard feelings. Uh-huh. But I'd publish something in the campus newspaper in January 2002 in opposition to the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan and the whole concept of the war on terror.
Yeah.
It was quite early on in this whole business. And a friend of mine suggested sending it to Counterpunch, which I did. And then I just started sending in commentary about Operation Balikitan in the Philippines and the Pangisi Gorge stuff in Georgia, just critiquing what I was reading in the news logically, because it looked to me as though there were lots of interventions that were being put under this general rubric of war on terror that were designed to prepare American public opinion for a massive series of interventions. And that's how I got started. My main work is on
Japan.
Tokugawa Japan,
yeah.
17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and that's enough work to occupy 60 hours a week, but I just felt morally and politically motivated and charged to make use of my research skills and writing skills to comment on things that had a bit more importance than 17th century Japan, at least at the time. And the time hasn't passed in which I feel like I need to contribute to this discussion.
More urgent, yeah. Do you feel that it's better than doing your own blog?
Well, my kids keep saying, "Dad, you should have a blog." But maybe I should.
It depends. If you have a lot of content in the blog, then it gets noticed, right? So, But I mean, you get noticed anyway on these other sites.
Right.
Do you? Is any negative feedback among your students at all?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. And I don't know how many of them pay attention. Some do. Some are very interested. But I think I have different kinds of relationships with different students in terms of helping them with their research on all kinds of arcane historical topics. And so this is not really central to my academic work at all.
How about this attempt to paint the academy as this hotbed of radicalism and try to, name names, I guess. And have you been targeted like that?
Not particularly. Occasionally I get on some list, and often I'm not, in which case I feel kind of neglected and disappointed. But I'm not one of those stellar figures like Chomsky. That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know, I have a humble role in all of this.
Yeah, you don't want to have a bodyguard or something.
I don't think we're there yet, no.
So, do you see that this is a historic occasion, right, this inauguration?
I do, and I don't think that should be downplayed in any way. It's very significant that in a country that was established by slave owners, we now have an African-American president. And the joy, the celebratory atmosphere, it should not be dismissed. It's not as though Obama is the descendant of slaves. He is the son of a Kenyan immigrant and a white woman from Kansas who grew up in Hawaii, like I did. I can kind of understand the environment that he had at Punahou High School. Oh. I went to Radford High School, which is a big rival of Punahou.
Oh,
I can understand him probably speaking an upper class version of Pidgin and knowing how to talk the kind to people all around the island and having a very multicultural attitude and the ability to negotiate culturally with a lot of different people. So I can see him getting along with all kinds of people, assessing situations very carefully. I think this is a historical moment. I think he's a very interesting kind of guy. I can see people assessing his character positively. I'm impressed with the way that he thinks on his feet, yeah. His articulate nature, his intelligence. It's very refreshing after watching a Bush press conference in which he's like a deer caught in the headlights, you know, who really doesn't understand the question or know how to answer it. And then you see Obama, who's polished and confident and intelligent. You know, I can see why a lot of African Americans in particular are very proud and will say things like, you know, Rosa Parks sat so that Martin Luther King could march, so that Obama could run, and now our children can fly and all that sort of thing. But he is the representative of the ruling class of a capitalist imperialist country, and he is in a way in a box in terms of how he can operate on the world stage. He's not going to change the system appreciably. The system is likely to go into further crisis, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've got a pretty face there with a lot of support. And, you know, it was moving for me to watch Bruce Springsteen standing there with Pete Seeger yesterday.
Oh.
And then even singing that kind of band stanza from the Woody Guthrie song, This Land Is Your Land.
Yeah.
You know, the one about, you know, the sign, no trespassing, and on the other sign, on the other side, it didn't say nothing.
Yeah.
That you're never allowed to sing in grade school.
Yeah,
because it's so communist. Well, they sang that right in front of Obama. I thought, wow, they never sing that part. Things like that are kind of moving. But, you know, what happens if he bombs Iran?
Yeah.
Then, you know, he's done something worse than Bush ever did.
Do you think the fact he was a community organizer has anything to do with it? How he deals with people now?
Well, maybe his ability to work with people is what allowed him to be a community organizer.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe those skills will serve him, unfortunately, in persuading people that, well, you know, we did have to bomb Iran.
Yeah.
But I would like some of his supporters to start asking him the difficult questions. Actually, they're not so difficult. But somebody should say, President Obama, in November 2007, all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, these are presumably professionals, people who train at places like the Fletcher School at Tufts University. I'm just mentioning that because, you know, some of these people I know.
Yeah.
These are like graduate students whom I would never recommend going into the CIA, but I, you know, these are people that I know to be intelligent, people of integrity who know how to do research.
Yeah.
But people like that from 16 intelligence agencies pronounce with a high degree of confidence that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. Repeat, does not have a nuclear weapons program and hasn't had one since 2003. And even that bit is highly dubious because the the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, was held up for over a year because Dick Cheney's office didn't like it. And there was even talk about it not being made public, or the synopsis of it not being made public. And it looks to me as though that bit of information, that there was one up until 2003, might have been inserted in order to allow it to be made public. In other words, that part might be disinformation itself, because if you say, well, they had one, but then they suspended it, it weakens the conclusions of the whole group. But the NIE says, anyway, they haven't had one since 2003. Nevertheless, the administration keeps saying that they're pursuing a nuclear weapon as though it's an acknowledged fact. And Obama has towed that line, including in his first press conference after being elected.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time. Thank you very much, Professor Gary Loop of Tufts University, talking about the risks that Obama faces and the challenges, I guess, and in continuing his role as this imperialist power of the United States. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Where did the time go? Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Professor Gary Loop. The audio will be online at kuci.org/subversity. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.